And the only reason why mule deer hunting is not as prevalent is because the tags are harder to come by. Now, I do about equal mule deer to coos deer ratio during the archery season because it's over the counter, but rifled, no. It's much harder to get a mule deer tag rifle here than it is a coos deer tag. So javelina season, there's three different seasons. There's your archery season, which is in January. It goes from the 1st to usually the 20th. And then there's the ham season, which is 2 weeks in the beginning of February. And then there's the rifle season, which is 1 week towards the end of February. So if you bought a tag as an out-of-stater or in-state and you came in January and you got skunked, you could come back again in August and then again in December. And the cool thing about it is if you come in December, you come after Christmas, you could kill one and then get another
tag. Right. January 1st.
First and then hunt again, yeah.
My two neighboring provinces that have black bears have spring bear hunts and have for years, like forever. And we have a bear issue here in my province, and they won't give us a spring bear hunt. Listen, guys, if we don't all fight together and I lose what I'm doing and I take up, you know, rock collecting or stamp collecting or something like that, when the time comes that they come after you, like you said, I'm not going to be there to support you because it's not going to be anything that I do anymore. So
right,
we all got to stick together as hunters, whether it's your thing or not.
Hey guys, before we get into this next episode, I want to share a couple things with you. First, I am happy to announce the new daysinthewild.com is finally launched. Everything is in one place, my guide services, the podcasts, access to my blogs, etc. So go check it out, daysinthewild.com. If you've been following the show lately, you know that we've partnered with Bushnell and Primos. The awesome thing about that is that if you use promo code STL02, you will save 15% on anything they sell. It doesn't have to be the stuff that I use. I've been using the Bushnell trail cameras for years. I did a couple of reviews over the years, and Bushnell always came out on top. They're excellent. And I know you've heard me talk about Primo's calls and how good they are, but I've also been using their ground blinds, and they're awesome. I don't know if you remember Double Bull blinds, but that's a Primo's product now, or has been for a while. I also tried out a set of their shooting sticks, and for standing shots or, you know, using for clients when we're predator hunting or my kids that need it when we're spot and stalk and have to get in close on javelina or anything like that. It's like a really good tool. I love them. They're quick setup and they're steady. Lastly, do yourself a favor and go check out the lineup of shooting bags, glassing pads, and other accessories that Phoenix Shooting Bags puts out. Go to phoenixshootingbags.com, use promo code John Stallone, all one word, and save 20%. Rifle season is upon us, guys. You'll thank me later, I promise. Go check them out. Hey, don't forget to give us a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening. It helps me keep bringing you guys content for free. It definitely helps out our ratings and reach more people. So thanks again for taking care of that. Appreciate it. Now let's roll into this next episode. Hey guys, this is another bonus episode for you. Got the opportunity to sit down with my buddy David Hartland, who's doing a podcast or quasi podcast called the Guide Shack. He's just having guides on and talking about, you know, hunting and different areas of their expertise. And he had me on his show to talk about hunting here in Arizona. And it's a good conversation, so check it out. And this is brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags.
Sitting down with a good friend of mine today, John Stallone, all the way from Arizona. John, how's things today in Arizona? I'm sure it's definitely warmer there than what it is here.
Oh, yeah, it's nice, man. The weather's crazy good right now. I think the low is like 48 this morning, and it's going to be about 70 today.
So, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, actually, I don't know what that converts into in Celsius, but here it's minus 21 with the wind.
Jesus. That's terrible.
That's what I said this morning when I went outside. I turned around, went right back in.
That's nuts. No, it's actually unseasonably warm. It's about 7 degrees warmer than it normally is as a whole, 7 to 10 degrees. You know, last year around this time, we actually had some snow. And Arizona doesn't see a whole, I mean, up in the north country, in the high country, yes, but like in the valley, and we don't see a whole lot of snow, but we got some snow. We were actually on a javelina hunt and we got snowed on. We were only at like 3,000 feet of elevation. We weren't, you know, like I said, up in the high country or anything. But yeah, from now to about May, that's when everybody wants to be here because the weather's just, you know, bluebird skies and
very. I got a buddy of mine from Wisconsin that comes up fishing with me every second year, and he's a snowbird. Like, he leaves Wisconsin. He probably 2 weeks ago, I think I was talking to him. He's getting ready to leave in a couple of days, and he said, "I won't be back to Wisconsin until at least mid to late May." He said, "I'll call home to check the weather reports." He said, "And I'll determine when I'm leaving Arizona."
Exactly. Yeah, we have a bunch of snowbirds. It's actually getting less and less now. I feel like a lot more people that were snowbirds are just moving here and just staying here now. But
okay. So you find things are getting built up quite bad.
Well, it's crazy, man. We got a giant influx of Californians of all places. And it's kind of making the housing market just absolutely nuts. Absolutely. I'm trying to buy a cabin right now with my wife, and a cabin that I could buy 2 years ago was like $150,000. I can't touch for under 400.
Yeah, it's crazy. Same thing here, like housing here ever since like the last year, whatever changed in the last year, it just like houses here are going up for sale for, we'll say, for ease of math, 200,000. Uh-huh. Within three days, they're sold for 240 or 260.
Yeah. Unreal.
Oh, like, you know, 40 and 60,000 over the asking price. Bidding wars on houses that a year ago, 2 years ago, weren't worth 175,000. Like,
exactly. Yep.
Same. And it's unfortunate. I hope people don't get stuck in these big mortgages, and when the market turns around and the interest rates go through the roof.
That's what happened in what, 2006, the same shit. They were giving away all these freaking mortgages for nothing. You know, you didn't even have to. Now, at least the mortgage process is a little bit is more like it was when I first bought my first house. But man, I bought houses for years using a stated income. You know, you didn't have to prove shit. It was like, you know, I make this much money. Okay, cool. Yeah. Here you go. Here's some money. And that's when all that, you know, it crashed like 2006, 2007. Everything fell out of because of that.
So are you from Arizona?
No, originally? From Brooklyn,
New York.
Yeah.
You don't have the accent. You left that in New York.
Oh, it's there. It's just not, it's not so predominant that it's crazy. Cause when I'm around my cousins and I'm around other people that are from New York, it comes out real strong, like real strong.
Oh yeah.
I think I dial it back. I think I've gotten in the habit of dialing it back. It's kind of a strange stigma. Or like, if you have a New York accent and you talk like a New Yorker, I think people think you're stupid a little bit. Like, they kind of look down their nose at you a little bit. They know you're streetwise, but they think you're not cultured or something. So I don't know. I think I learned to dial it back a little bit over the years, and my normal speech. I mean, there's definitely words that I say, you know, I'm from back east, but it's
that's like no matter how much I try, you can definitely tell I'm from Canada, though, can't you? Eh?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Eh?
Exactly.
Too funny. So what do you got on the go down there? I know what you're doing, but tell some of the viewers about some of the cool things you're doing down there. I mean, there's not too many people I know that have the diversity in their guiding program that you do. So it's pretty cool stuff.
Thank you. So primarily I guide here in Arizona, and for Arizona, I do, our mainstay is probably coos deer more than anything, but we do.
Which is a cool niche.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. It's an awesome little animal. It's gained a lot of popularity in the last, I want to say, 10 years or so, but it's still kind of an underrated deer because a lot of people from like Midwest, or, you know, they're like, oh, I want to come shoot a small whitetail. But it until they come and do it and experience it. It's like, it's almost like going on a sheep hunt. Like that's the experience that you're getting. And you know, when you see a 110-inch rack on a 90-pound animal, it looks like you're looking at a 160-inch whitetail from the Midwest, you know. That's the, you know, the proportion. So we do a lot of coos deer hunts. Next to that would be probably mule deer hunting. And the only reason why mule deer hunting is not as prevalent is because the tags are harder to come by. Now, I do about equal mule deer to coos deer ratio during the archery season because it's over the counter, but rifle, no. It's much harder to get a mule deer tag rifle here than it is a coos deer tag, or cow's deer is actually the correct pronunciation for it, but anybody who's from Arizona calls them coos. And then we do elk hunting. Again, I do 2, maybe 3 clients a year, elk, because of the tag situation. They're tough to get. And I don't have the clientele built up that has been putting in with me for years and years.
I got 1 year in. I put in this year.
Yeah.
You walked me through. So if anybody wants to go, if anybody wants to put in for Arizona elk and wants to hunt with John, he can walk you through the process. It's pretty painless, and you can get an extra point that you never lose if you take the, which I haven't done that yet. I will admit I haven't done that, but I know I can do it. So,
but you see, the thing about that is you have to come here one day and do the 1 day in field class. So it's kind of hard for people to do that, but that's why they reward you with a permanent bonus point. And then
I thought you could do that online.
You could do the testing online, but the in school, you can't. The in field day, you have to do in person. And with COVID and crap, it's been a pain in the ass to do that on top of it. Both my wife and my middle daughter have taken it, completed the testing online, and still have not been able to get into a class because they're so limited. So hopefully as that opens up, you know, back when it was before COVID, we were, you know, getting people into those classes. Like, I think there was like 1 or 2 a month, you know, it wasn't hard. So that's one way to get a permanent point. And then after you've put in for 5 years, you get a loyalty point for the species that you're applying for. So okay. If you put for elk and deer for 5 years straight, you get a loyalty point. And you don't lose that loyalty point unless you don't put in for 2 consecutive years. Then you lose it.
Gotcha. So and you're almost guaranteed, or you are guaranteed with 7 points?
No. Every hunt is different and it changes from year to year. You know, I don't know if you ever heard of that, the point creep term. There's point creep. But the cool thing about Arizona that's much different than a lot of these states that run point systems and preference point systems is that you pretty much have a mathematical chance, or you have a mathematical chance, not pretty much, guaranteed a mathematical chance every year. So there's guys, you know, for instance, we took a sheep hunter out 3 years ago, and he only had 3 points and he got a desert sheep. Now, max pool for desert sheep is 25 points. So, you know,
that's a cool tag to draw. But
look at the draw. My cousin Anthony, who owns Phoenix Shooting Bags, he drew with 6 or 7 points, also not enough points. So he got a random tag. Me, when I drew mine, even though I had 16 points, I still wasn't in the bonus point pool. So Arizona allots and I don't remember the percentages right now, but X amount of percentage for out-of-state hunters, X amount of percent for in-state hunters. Then there is, you put in 5 choices for each hunt. And the first pass is your bonus point pass. The bonus point pass. And then that's everybody who has max points for that species in that unit. And then there is, and that only looks at your first and second choice. And then there's the random draw. Okay, now there's X amount of tags available for the random draw. Same thing. It only looks at first and second choice. And then from there, it goes to, you know, the general, basically a general draw pass through, or the last pass. And that, you know, if there's tags, if your number, how can I explain this? All right. So think of it like this. If I have 5 bonus points and there's a big hat, okay, I stick my hand in the hat 5 times and I pull out 5 different numbers. And whatever my lowest number, that's my position in line. Okay. So when it comes to my position in line, and let's say, for instance, I drew the number 2. I'm guaranteed a tag if I draw number 2. But if I drew, let's say, tag or number 1,000, right? I have to hope that the 1,000 people in front of me weren't putting in for a unit that I put in for. So that's, you know, there's always a chance for you to get it. It's just.
Yeah. Could you get drawn on your first year?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I still might have a chance then.
You have a chance. Well, they're hitting cards today, matter of fact.
Oh, so wouldn't that be awesome if my phone rang right now and said that I got a tag?
If your credit card that you used gets a charge from the fishing game today, you drew a tag.
Oh, I'd love to make that call back to you tonight.
Yeah, exactly. And the guy that I guided last year, I think only had 3 points, and he drew a pretty primos elk tag last year. We had unit 8. We were on some big bulls, you know, the last 4 days of the hunt. It was a little slow season, but we were on a big bull the last 4 days of the hunt. And he ended up getting a bull. He shot that raghorn that was with the big bull, but it was a great hunt. He had a great time and he was super happy.
Why was the season slow? Abnormally warm?
Very warm. Very warm. Same
year for moose.
Super dry. We had a super dry year for everything this year. So going back to one of the other things that that's pretty unique to Arizona that we hunt and we do very well with that hunt is the javelina hunting. And yeah. It's super popular. It's crazy because I always thought of it as a fill-in hunt for us. You know, we fill in our seasons with predator hunting, which we do very well too, and javelina hunting. And javelina hunting is in the last like 5 years for us has grown. Like we used to like, you know, take 2-3 guys, whatever, a season just to kind of fill in the gaps. And now I'm doing like 3-4 camps and taking 12 guys each time, you know. It's just I never wanted to be, you know, I didn't want to be for javelina hunting, you know.
Yeah, but if people like it, you're having fun doing it.
Because it's a very high success rate hunt.
Gives you an opportunity to be scouting for other animals while you're out there also.
Exactly. We have in the last 5, well, I think now last 7 years, we have 100% shot opportunity and almost 100% success rate. I don't know as far as statistics, I'll let you digest this and tell me what you think, but the only guys that didn't get one, I had 2 different guys now that came and they only came for 1.5 days of the 3-day hunt. They both had shot opportunities and missed and didn't go home with one. They had to leave or they wanted to leave, but they said they had to leave. I don't know what the case was, but unfortunately they didn't get one. So that kind of skews my statistics now. But
well, I know up here with moose in Newfoundland in particular, the success rate has always been based on opportunity.
Uh-huh.
So if you have the opportunity to shoot a bull moose and you turn it down,
right,
that counts as success for the elk fair. That's been common practice up this way. So success is measured in different ways as well too, right? Like, right.
Yeah.
You know, most of the people that I've guided that have turned down animals because they were looking for a trophy, and I don't blame them. I'd be the same way. Like, you know, the old saying goes, don't pass down Monday morning what you'd shoot Friday afternoon. But any of the guys that I ever sent home that had opportunities to shoot moose that went home with Oda moose were always okay.
Right.
So I don't know what the situation was like there. Hopefully they didn't leave. I mean, they left halfway through their hunt too. So
yeah, no. Yeah.
But I think you should count. I think you should count as 100% opportunity.
Yeah,
that's my opinion.
Yeah, well, 100% opportunity. Yeah, I could say that for 100% because they both shot and missed. So one guy had to leave because he had a he had an emergency, and the other one left because, well, we lost a day, and then the next day we lost a day because it was snowing so bad that it just Javelina don't like inclement weather at all. And then the next day he was with his dad, and his dad shot one, and that's when he had an opportunity. It wasn't a great shooting opportunity, but he took it and he missed. And then for whatever reason, I think he had to get back for work or something. He had to miss the last day. So he really technically only hunted that one day.
Yeah.
And I know
he's unfortunate for everybody.
I know he would have got one. I just, you know.
So what's the average size of these? We don't have javelina up here, and I've never seen one. So, like, are we talking like an average size of like a 30-pound pig, a 50-pound pig?
I'd say that most of the boars we take are between 40 and 60 pounds, and the sows are 30 to 50.
Okay.
Yeah.
And those are average. Now, what would a big boar be?
I've only killed one that was right in that 70-something pound range, and it was during archery. 70's a big one. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was like 70. I didn't really weigh him. I just kind of grabbed a luggage type deal, and yeah. I kind of hung him up, and it was like, oh wow, 70. That was like 73 pounds. This was going back several years ago, and it was in one of our metro units. It was actually here, not far from where I live. So my guess is he was probably eating on a lot of landscaping and getting into people's garbages and whatnot.
Yeah. So that brings me to my next question: are these a problem animal in the metro areas?
No, not really. I mean, a little bit, you know. They could be like, my mother-in-law is having an issue right now where they're every night they're coming in and they're eating her plants in the front, and they're, you know, they do a little bit of that, but they don't do a whole lot of damage. They'll knock over a couple of garbage cans and whatever, and, you know, get into stuff if they need to. But for the most part,
they're not like a pig. They don't root up ground.
They do. They like tubers, but they're not nearly as destructive as pigs are. That's like a secondary thing for them. They'd rather eat on succulents and, you know, stuff that they don't have to dig for, but they will dig for tubers. And the cool thing, like at least in the areas that I hunt, we find that the things that they're digging are the plants that we don't really want anywhere. They're like, I don't know what it is, but they love cat's claw. They're always digging up the roots of cat's claw, which is a freaking pain in the ass here. Like, I mean,
yeah.
North facing slopes, you got covered, and you can't even go up it because it's so bad. But you know, they can get into everything. But yeah, you know, they're eating on prickly pear paddles, and you know, we have.
So what do they like to eat?
Yeah, mostly succulents.
What do they like to eat? Like, are they a good table meat?
Yeah, actually, you know, it's so funny. I would say the majority of people you talk to they'll make the comment, you know, that they're terrible and they taste like they smell, and you know what? And I kind of was that way when I first started hunting them years and years ago, but then I learned how to cook them. I learned one way about 10, 15 years ago, or probably about 15 years ago, how to do like the back straps and stuff like that. I learned like a special marinade and how to do them on the grill. And those were good. And that's what I kept on doing. And I'd always give like the legs away to, so I'm in construction also here. And I have a lot of Hispanic, Mexican people that work for me. So I'd give it to them, and they would bring me back like green chili and, you know, other type of stuff, which was good, you know, but I didn't know how to do it. But I learned how to do, four or five different recipes, and man, now I get people asking me for it, you know?
Nice. Well, that's good that it gets used, right? Cause, everything tastes good if you just learn how to cook it.
Right. Right. Well, I don't know about that. my Ibex was terrible. Was absolutely terrible, and I tried a couple of different recipes that were like, oh yeah, this is the best way to do it. It was absolutely terrible.
And what was it like? Explain why
Barbary sheep is not very good. Also,
they just Like, are they musty or?
Musty, tough like shoe leather, no matter what. Like, I tried slow cooking, I tried smoking. I mean, no. Terrible. Absolutely. But I'm sure there's somebody who figured it out there. I haven't figured out who that person is yet. And so I don't know if I'll ever draw another tag. It took me 10 years to draw the first tag. And so we'll see.
Were you on any sheep hunts this year?
No. None of my clients drew. You know, every year we go and take a little inventory just in case we draw somebody. So I know, you know, where we could get into them. I hunt, you know, two or three specific units for sheep. They happen to be the three units that are I don't want to use the word easiest, but the easiest, the most likely for you to draw in a random situation, because they have the most amount of tags and the most amount of sheep also. The trophy units, like the super trophy units, I don't even look at those anymore, because there's guys that are so well established in those units that if people draw that hunt, they're going to go to them. And
they know their area, or same as you know your area.
Yeah, I've been in there, you know, and I found some giants, but it's just one of those things, you know. It's like I don't know. I don't think I can compete, so it's not something that I spend a lot of time on. There's guys that've been doing it longer than me, and like I said, have it kind of, you know, that's their thing. That's all they do is pretty much sheep hunting those, you know, three, four units, and that's it.
So your antlered animals are all draw, and I think it's pretty obvious when those seasons are. When can somebody come with you to hunt javelina?
So javelina season, there's three different seasons. There's your archery season, which is in January. It goes from the 1st to usually the 20th. And then there's the ham season, which is 2 weeks in the beginning of February. And then there's the rifle season, which is 1 week towards the end of February.
So they are limited seasons. It's not like so your predator's probably pretty much open.
Predator's almost open year round. Well, it's year round for coyote and almost year round for mountain lion. But bobcat, fox, quatamundi, any of the fur bearers, there's a season. I got to look at the start date. I believe it's August 1st. And it goes to March 31st. We close March 31st for fur bearer. The javelina also has an over-the-counter tag. It's archery only, and it's in the metro units. And that coincides with deer season and surpasses it, basically. So it starts in, like, some units it's in August. Others it starts in December. You got to look. The regs keep changing. But that's a fairly liberal season. It goes pretty much from like any time that deer season starts to the end of when kind of the javelina season ends, like the draw tags. We don't do a whole lot with that. Like I'll personally hunt that, and I take javelina during that almost every year. Did not this year, and didn't really spend any time. But I don't really guide that because it's unpredictable. And if somebody's coming out with me, I want them, you know, I want to know that they're going to have
opportunity.
Very, very good chance of getting one, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I never promise anybody, but if there was one hunt that I was going to promise you, you're going to get one, it's a javelina season, you know, during the draw.
You guys got quite a few of them there, right?
There's a lot of them. They're not like, there's more deer than javelina. Yeah, they're not like around every bush, you know, but they travel in groups. If they didn't travel in groups, I don't think people would really be able to kill them, because they're really hard to see. They're really hard to find. They're low to the ground. So if they're in the ground cover, you don't see them. I think that's the hardest thing people have with them is finding them.
Is there a trophy on javelina? Like, do people save the skulls or the teeth? Or?
Yep. The skull is measured just like a bear.
Okay, so there is book, recorded record books.
Yep, Pope and Young recognizes them, and then I don't think Boone and Crockett does, but no, Pope and Young does, and the Arizona bow hunters also recognize
them. How many other states have javelina? Like, does New Mexico have them? And
New Mexico, Texas. Texas, they're actually like a nuisance there. Their populations are exploded, I guess. And I think their season is almost year round on them. If I remember right, yeah. I think I'm pretty sure it's year round on javelina. But they occupy so much of it's on private land that, you know.
A lot of Texas is pretty much private land. So
exactly. So it's not a really great place to hunt. Now, New Mexico, this year we started guiding there, and I'm taking a select few clients with us that have hunted with us before to that hunt. I work with another outfitter there who is running, you know, keeping us all legal and stuff and running the actual hunt, but I will be there, you know, assisting. And if that turns out, we'll probably start offering. So their season's a lot more liberal, and their tags are over the counter. So you could purchase the tag over the counter, and it goes to the end of March, which is, you know, so it's a little bit longer season and more opportunity. Our deer hunts, our archery deer hunts, which, like I said, is probably the most popular thing we do next to javelina, or above javelina, is that's over the counter as well. So we can, you know, if you want to.
This is all mule deer, no whitetails, right?
Whitetail and mule deer, both.
Oh, okay.
So your tag, if you buy an over-the-counter archery tag, it's good for either species, but only for bucks. It's not either sex.
And one animal.
And you're only allowed to take one in a calendar year. Those seasons, we got a pretty long season too for archery deer. It's actually, it's broken up into three different seasons or three different times. Cause it's still called archery season, but we have the first season is January 1st to January 31st in a calendar year, which is the rut. Okay. That is the most, I guess, popular time to go hunting for them. Then we have August, usually around the 20th to about September 14th. So you get another month there. And then it opens again. It'll close, you know, once it closes, it opens again after the rifle seasons and during the rifle rut hunt, quote unquote rifle rut hunt, which is December 15th to the 31st. So you have three cracks at it. So if you bought a tag as an out-of-stater or in-state, and you came in January and you got skunked, you could come back again in August and then again in December. And the cool thing about it is if you come in December, you come after Christmas, you can kill one and then get another
tag.
Right.
January 1st.
First, and then hunt again. Yeah. We have a lot.
So the actual thing to do would be come down the end of December after Christmas, hunt a week.
Right.
Stay another week.
Yeah. So this year I started offering, we were doing a 10-day hunt, 5 days, the last 5 days of December. You come and we hunt water holes and we sit you on water holes for the first 5 days. And then the second 5 days we switch to spot and stalk, and you have the opportunity to get two deer. And I had two clients come and do that, and both of them tagged out both times, which is great.
Did they tag out one in each species?
Yeah. Yep, that's exactly
That's what I'd want to do too. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. That's what I'd want to do. I'd rather shoot two muleys because I haven't shot any muleys. I've shot a few whitetail.
Right.
And I actually brought this one to show you. I don't know if you ever seen this one before, but this is one of the last big bucks that I shot.
Ah, that's a nice one, man. A lot of character.
168 and 3/8 Boone and Crockett, and his brow tines are 20 giant. Inches total.
That's giant, man. That's crazy. Well, where did you get him?
Here in Nova Scotia.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know you guys had good deer in Nova Scotia. I thought that big body deer there, but.
Well, actually, we're not like Saskatchewan. Like Saskatchewan, like they're known for the 300-pound deer. Like personally, myself, I've shot a few nice big bucks over my time. Been very fortunate. Had a lot of time to pursue them after my guiding season in Newfoundland for moose. I would have all deer season off, so I had lots of time to pursue. And
right,
but here, like you talk about a deer that's over 200 pounds. Like if you shoot a deer that's 200 pounds or 205 or 220, You know, you talk about it. We do have deer that are 250, 260 at the beginning of the season, but by the time the rut comes, they're never that big. Like that deer I just showed you, I chased him for 3 years before I got him. Uh-huh. He was 7.5 years old when I did kill him, and he was rutted right out. Like I've never seen a deer with so little fat on it before, and he was 172 pounds.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, but yeah, he would have been over 200, you know, at the beginning of the season, but.
Right.
Yeah. Like we do, we get big antlers here. Our population of deer is pretty good, but, and we have a lot of public land, so it offers a lot of opportunity, but we don't have big herds. Like rattling deer and calling deer here isn't the main way people pursue.
No. Yeah.
So we're allowed to bait here. So you can drive in with a half ton truck, shovel off, you know, 700 pounds of apples at your bait site. And,
sweet.
Like, yeah. Sweet. It's like Ted Nugent. Ted Nugent one time, he said he got a bit of trouble for baiting there many, many, many years ago. I remember one of his conversations on his show or one of his movies I was watching. They said, they asked the Nuge if I bait. And I said, well, I sit in oak trees and I hunt over oaks. So I guess I bait. He said, and I sit on the edge of cornfields and watch cornfields. So I guess you might consider that bait. He said, and I sit in apple trees. He said, and I hunt over apples. He said, and sometimes when the apples stop falling from that tree, I'll help them fall again. So I always laughed at that, right? I always like talking to whenever I think of Ted Nugent, I always think of that story. So
that's funny.
Yeah. So what do you got on the go in the next little bit? And it sounds like your seasons are starting to wind out on you.
Yeah, I have that javelina hunt coming up. And right now we're just getting through tag season. I told you earlier, they're conducting the draw right now for elk. So we'll see if we drew anybody and start working on getting that together. But I'm constantly, you know, I also guide in South Dakota. I didn't mention that earlier, but guide in South Dakota, and I have a business partner of mine that I do bookings for him. I don't guide for him there, but in California we do hog hunting year round, turkey hunts and blacktail hunts. So yeah,
but you got lots on the go to offer. Yeah. Anybody wants to look and get into anything, you can pretty much send them to do anything year round.
Yeah, South Dakota is probably my most coveted. I'm booked out now 2 years.
And that's for whitetails?
No. Nah, well, you know, I do offer whitetail hunting, and we do occasionally take whitetail, but most of people come from mule deer. Yeah. You want to talk about big body, those bucks are 330 pounds.
Is that on a draw system?
For archery, it is not. It is a first come, first serve tag. So you go purchase.
Can you buy online?
You can buy online, yes.
So you don't have to be there in person?
No. No, you can buy it online, and once they've sold out whatever they want to sell for that year, then you're done. But I don't think I've ever seen them sell out, to be honest with you. So they give them a crap ton of tags. The rifle hunt is a draw. Usually takes about 4 or 5 points about 5 points where we hunt. I actually don't take rifle hunters on the properties that we lease, because I'm just trying to keep the experience as pristine as possible. Right now, everybody I've ever taken there has been like, this is like, it's like the Mecca. It's so awesome. I look forward to it every year. Like I go hunt for myself, and then I guide people. I did it. I got into it because I like to hunt it so much, and I didn't want to lose the leases. So, you know, I had to make it attractive to the landowners and make some, you know, throw some more money his way. Yeah. Really, that's honestly, otherwise I would not have done it. I mean, it's not so much the trophy quality, because the trophy quality is better here in Arizona. It's just
a cool hunt.
It's the amount of deer and the experience. Like, you go there, one, it's private land, so the deer are not very pressured. Not that they're stupid by any means. Like, you know, they see you, you know. They're
yeah, gone. It's not a high fence hunt.
They see you, but they're gone. But it's just
easier to put a strategy on them.
Everything works there. You can use Midwest whitetail tactics, like rattling, grunting. You can call them. You can decoy them. spot and stalk. You can sit in a tree stand if you want to. You could sit on a cornfield if you want. Like you can do all that. Everything works. And we've done it all. Nice. I've taken every way with decoy, with, you know, calling, with rattling. Yeah. Everything. So, you know, everything works. You gotta pick the right situations and know what the hell you're doing. I'm not saying you can just go out there willy nilly and, you know, smack horns together and you're going to get a buck come in, but you have, like, it's just one of those magical places that.
So you're rattling in mule deer.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's cool. That's something I haven't seen too much of.
Yeah. Actually, there's a little clip. He's a smaller buck, but he's a little 3x3 that runs up of me rattling. If you go on my YouTube, there's a piece, put it in the comments. Yeah, three South Dakota hunts on there. Actually, one of the ones where I kill a whitetail spot and stalk is actually a public land hunt. So I used to go public land hunt. It's even great. There's great public land hunting there too, but it's kind of like a little few and far between to find the places. But the places that are available, if you're not afraid to hike. And you're going during the archery season, you're not going to see people. If you go during the rifle season, it's a freaking war zone.
Yeah, not interested in that.
No, absolute war zone. Because it's one of the few states where you could rifle hunt during the rut. So the peak of the rut is when the rifle season opens. It's like November 14th.
Yeah, like our deer hunt here, it opens up in September, early September for archery.
Right.
And then our archery season runs from September to the second Saturday in December.
Okay.
And the only days that it's closed are Sundays. We're allowed 2 days a year, I think, that we can hunt on Sunday, which is totally lame in this day and age.
I know, right?
Yeah, you can go to Costco and, you know, spend a bunch of money and buy meat, but you can't go get fresh meat for your family. Anyways, that's a whole other show.
Yeah, they're actually got a bill right now in I think Connecticut that they're trying, or New Hampshire or something, that they're trying to eliminate that very same. You know, there's a lot of back east, like New England, that still has counties that have that same
restriction.
Yeah. You can't run on Sunday. I think that was a church thing, I think.
Yeah, and which, you know, I can agree on that if everything was closed. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but yeah.
When you got a great big shopping mall with 300 stores in it open and people in there all walking around.
Right.
If they're all in the shopping mall, they're not in the woods, so.
Yeah. When I first moved to Arizona, you couldn't buy liquor on Sundays.
Yeah, well, we couldn't buy liquor here for years. Now the government realized that they were losing money to the bootlegger, right?
Yeah. Now it's a free for all over here. It's crazy.
Yeah. But we still can't buy liquor in stores here. You actually have to go to a government run liquor store. You can buy, we can't walk into like the average gas station and buy beer here, but yet I can leave and go to all my neighboring provinces and walk into a gas station and buy beer on any day of the week. And my two neighboring provinces that have black bears have spring bear hunts and have for years, like forever. And we have a bear issue here in my province and they won't give us a spring bear hunt. Instead, what they did was they gave the trappers two tags a year.
Okay.
Nobody traps anymore.
Bears are always an area contention because the problem we're seeing. So we just beat a bear ban in California. That same partner I was talking about, his name is Charles Wibon. Him and I are, you know, kind of spearheading, working on projects right now that, you know, it's a conservation project, but it's a pro hunting project where we're trying to beat these bills, that these anti-hunting bills that are coming up here in the United States before they make it to, you know, legislature or before they even go to court or any of that stuff. I'm just trying to, you know, get people involved. And one of the things, you know, so bears, like I said, bears always an area of contention because there's so many hunters out there that don't bear hunt or that are against bear hunting or lion hunting or predator hunting. You know, there's somehow, oh, I only hunt for meat.
And that's cool, but don't condone somebody else for why they hunt or what they're hunting for, because they're not saying anything about you, right?
Well, you know, what we're trying to get people to realize is that we're all in this together. And, you know, bear hunting is just the first step. It's the gateway, you know, is the gateway to get to what they want to get rid of all hunting. That's what the agenda is. That's what Hughes is doing. That's what, you know, these organizations, anti-hunting organizations, they start with one thing and then they get that and you give it up because you're like, oh, it's just that. And I don't do that. And, let's just give it to them. You know, let's just shut them up. Yep, and give it to them.
100%.
And now they're coming, and eventually they're going to come for something that you love. And now the people that, you know, are predator hunters, bear hunters, trappers, whatever, they're no longer around because they lost what they were passionate about. Yep. And now they're not here to stand up with you and you're left alone. And
100%. And here, the same thing's happening here in Canada. Like the, you know, our lovely, leader, I can't call him a prime minister. I'll call him a leader or a king.
Yeah.
He's taken away all the black guns. If it's black, it's a military assault rifle. So in the media's or in the general public's eye that doesn't know any different, they think, okay, there was a mass shooting done in, you know, Las Vegas with an AR-15. Uh-huh. They must be horrible guns. Well, little do they know, that exact same gun, the exact same way it works, the exact same barrel, same bullet, and you put that on a black rifle, it's one gun. You put it on a wooden stock, they look totally different. It's the same gun.
Right.
Right? But they don't realize this. So now now we got the problem here in Canada because there's not a lot of people in Canada, really, realistically, compared to the United States that own black guns or, you know, right, AR platform guns. And they're... So many of the general hunters like you or I are sitting back and going, well, should I care? I don't shoot that. And really, why does anybody need that? They don't hunt with it. Well, no, they don't hunt with it, but they're, you know, they're a competition shooter or, you know, yeah, they just love, you know, they love, maybe they're ex-military and, right, and, you know, they just like the, and by no means is an AR a military rifle. If we went to any of the wars that we went into in the last, you know, 40 or 50 years with a regular AR-15, you know, we would have lost every war. They're not a military firearm. If you look up military grade or assault rifle, the only definition that's actually physically out there is from the FBI, which is on your side of the border, has nothing to do with Canada. And one of the first things that it is it's a fully automatic firearm.
Right.
Well, yeah. AR-15s aren't fully automatic, so... But the general public doesn't know these things. And if you try to educate them, well, first of all, we're all squashed now in the social media side of things anyway. Our voices don't really get heard much anymore, but we're the silent majority anyways. And there's not much we can do about it. And it's the same thing going on with your bear hunts there. Like people just, right, well, that has nothing to do with me. But listen, guys, if we don't all fight together and I lose what I'm doing and I take up, you know, rock collecting or stamp collecting or something like that, when the time comes that they come after you, like you said, I'm not going to be there to support you because it's not going to be anything that I do anymore. So
right,
we all got to stick together as hunters, whether it's your thing or not, like, you know, like
hunters and fishermen,
honestly. Hunters and fishermen. Yeah.
It's all rolled into the same thing. And really right now, the only thing that's kept us here is the fact that we have such an economic impact and the powers that be are greedy as fuck, excuse my French, but yep, we have such an economic impact and we generate so much money for, and our system here, and you guys don't have this, but you know, with our taxing on sporting goods and stuff like that, all that money goes to conservation. If that money goes away, then they don't have that and then they don't care, you know? Yep. So what they've been doing sneakily, if they keep coming up with these bills and they keep coming up with these, you know, ways to take money or to come up with money, not to take money, but to come up with money to fund conservation that circumvents the sportsman. And sportsmen are like, oh, cool, cool, more money for, and we're not thinking about it. We're not, you know, not looking at it with the, you know, through the, to the right scope.
The big picture.
The big picture, exactly, is they're doing that so that they can have the argument, we don't need hunters for conservation. Look how much money we can generate this way. We don't need that money.
Yeah.
And then you become less, the sportsman becomes less relevant.
You become an asset. You become a liability instead of an asset.
Exactly. And then, you know, it only goes back to, you know, there's other than money. I mean, the hunters, anglers, they're used as management tools, but you know, the other side has an argument for everything.
Yeah. Something we did here years ago, and this is what we should be doing as hunters. We should be organized hunters, fishermen all together, like you said. And I hope everybody's listening to this because this is a real good point. Many years ago, we had an organization that was trying to shut down something, like shut down an area and make it, you know, so you couldn't drive your four wheelers, you couldn't get in there with outboard motors to fish. And these were places that my grandfather fished for years. And I mean, you're not getting in there without a four wheeler to get the boat in there.
Right.
Guys used to leave boats in there and, you know, used to row around, but you can't leave stuff around anymore because people beat it up or steal it. So times have changed. So you got to take everything with you when you go, and you don't want to leave a bunch of stuff in the woods either. So this organization they formed, and they were fighting against us. So we formed an organization, and then we come up with a brilliant idea. Okay. So we've got more people in our organization, but they're making more noise than we are. We're the silent majority. So let's join their organization. Yeah. So we all walked in, we all paid our membership and joined their organization at their annual general meeting, mm-hmm. outvoted their members of their board of directors, and appointed our new board of directors and dissolved the committee.
Beautiful. That's awesome.
Yeah. Right. So imagine if we all as hunters all walked into the annual general meeting of, you know, San Francisco's chapter of PETA.
Yeah.
And voted them out.
Yeah. That'd be huge.
Genius, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And we have the power to do it. There's definitely more of us than there is them. If we all got together, oh, yeah. Hunters and fishermen joined together and went and did it.
We proved that. With that bear bait, like we got that thing shut down in 5 days. It's scary how much money, how much resources, power that we have, but we've never had a singletary organizational group that keeps that takes in everybody and says,
in everybody and keeps the direction going, right?
Exactly. You know, and that's always been our problem. We've never had, you know, it's always been an organization problem. Anti-hunters have no problem, you know, the Save the Whale guys have no problem locking arms with the Save the Polar Bear guys on issues if it's working towards their agenda, right? Where,
yeah.
You know, we had the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. We had the sheep, you know, and they work a little bit on habitat stuff and conservation stuff, which is great because we need that. But when it comes to fighting and getting things done,
lobbying government,
they don't really do a great job of it. And they're not, nope. You know, and going back to what we were saying, like there's so many hunters that are like, oh, well, I don't lion hunt. I don't bear hunt. I don't bow hunt. I don't, you know. I don't use an AR-15, whatever. And so they don't care.
Right.
But that's the main mission of what we're trying to do, is we're trying to get people to understand that you got to care. Because whether you do it or not, whether it's your cup of tea, whether you even like it or approve of it, you know, unless it's something that puts hunting in a bad light, you know, like, I don't know. Running hogs over with your ATV or something, yeah. You know, ridiculous, yeah. And stupid, something that
a real
sportsman would never do. You know, you need to support it. If it's right. Legal, if it's in a good light, you should do it. You should support it. And that's, well, I've been saying this for years. Been saying this for years and years, man. I've been pushing it, and you know, it constantly falls on deaf ears, but I think people are starting to wake up now, especially in the light of what happened here in the United States with this last election. That, I mean, come on. I don't want to get into politics, but
yeah, I think we're both on the same wavelength.
So, you know, and I think that was a big eye opener. It's an eye opener for sportsmen, you know, all over the place that,
yeah,
hey, you're not safe. No matter how strong, how much money, how much, you know, laws.
As much of a right as we think it is to be hunters, it's not a right. It's now a privilege.
Well, that's funny. There's several states in the United States where it is a right. And I think a lot of people are trying to get that passed. So, and I don't know, but there's a sportsman's caucus, Congressional Sportsman's Caucus, or Congressional Sportsman's Alliance. And if you go on the website, I'd have to look that up for you, but you go on the website and you look it up, it tells you, you know, it'll tell you all the information. It'll show you which states have, you know, the right and which don't, you know, which is just a privilege or whatever. Like I know California, it's a right to fish, but it's not a right to hunt. They're trying, you know, I think they're trying to push to get that to be a right to hunt. It's basically written into their state's constitution, which is, I mean, huge for everybody if they can get, you know, we get that passed on, you know,
especially as precedents too, right?
Yep, exactly. You know, and I would imagine that would be something you guys could do with each province too. You know,
yeah,
that would be huge. I mean, we're essentially United States and Canada, the two biggest hunting countries in the world, and I think after that is Spain or.
Yeah, it's the Spaniards are pretty big.
Australia, but
I didn't even think they allowed to own guns in Australia anymore.
Yeah, I think it's mostly bow hunting. Yeah, big bow hunting. A lot of archery stuff coming out of Australia these days. Yeah. So,
go down and get a kangaroo there.
Yeah, no, they got four or five different deer species. A lot, you know. I actually did a podcast not too long ago with one of my buddies who owns Ozcut. It's a broadhead company out of Australia, and he was telling me all the different opportunities. I'm going to go there eventually, as soon as all this COVID shit goes away. You know, when it magically disappears.
I know we both got to get going here, but. You had quite the ordeal when COVID started. I thought I was bad. Like I was in Cuba. Right now, this time last year, I was down there for a month. And like, I wasn't sure I was going to get home. Like everything was shut down at home. And I'm like, okay, well, I still got like 5 days before I can even get out of here. Is my plane going to be allowed in Canada? Yeah, I got home. No problem. But how about you?
I got stuck there for an additional 21 days.
And you were where?
In Argentina.
Argentina.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was crazy. Like you went to the airport. I remember following the whole story. I was relaying it to my wife, and I'm like, geez, I thought I had it bad. Like this guy's actually not getting home. And it was, you guys had to charter a plane. You met up with a bunch of other people that were stuck in the same situation. You chartered a plane and cost you like, I don't know, what was it? Like 140 grand for everybody to get home or something.
We didn't end up having to charter. So we were trying to charter a plane that was going to cost like somewhere around between $150,000 and $200,000. I chartered a small plane to get us from the regional airport that we were to Buenos Aires. That was 10 grand. You know, it was a dual prop plane. The eight of us got on there, or seven of us rather, got on there and got to Buenos Aires. But what happened was I had found out through a mutual friend who contacted me. He said, hey, listen, this company, Eastern Airlines, is chartering planes out of other South American countries to Miami. And I got a hold of my contact that I've been talking to at the embassy in Buenos Aires. And I said, hey, listen, you need to get a hold of Eastern Airlines. Cause at the time there was like 400 of us Americans or 300 of us Americans that were trying to get out for something like that. I think it was 400, trying to get out. He got a hold of them and was able to charter a charter them. So it ended up costing us, when all, you know, 300-400 of us, whatever, got on the plane, was like $2,000 a person. So to leave.
So, but the lodge let you stay there for the extra 21 days, did they not?
Yeah, if we continued to hunt. So we had to continue to hunt. And he made us a great deal. The guy's just, you know, he was a class act. I mean, let me just give you an idea. Like a stag that would cost like $15,000 was, you know, was charging you $2,000. So he's like, as long as you guys keep on hunting, because he goes, you know, my season's done. I had 80 other people coming after you. I'm not going to make any money. So, you know, the staff's already here. They can't leave. They weren't allowed to leave. We were all quarantined. The whole staff, all the guys were quarantined there for 2 weeks. So he's like, just keep on hunting. And so, you know, we made deals. Each of us made deals with him. We're like, all right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And that's what kept us. Otherwise, it would have, you know, would have costed like $500 a day. Just to
start. You might as well hunt.
Yeah, that's the way it was. Yeah. So, you know, and I'm faced with this thing like, oh shit, I'm going to have to spend, you know, we're going to have to come up with $200,000 to get a private jet and this and that. And then, you know, that came about like literally the last second. It was like the last 2 days before we left. That's when we found out we were going on that. And that was a whole ordeal to begin with, another ordeal with that. We lost our seats. We had to wait for 6 hours in the airport. It was a shit show. I didn't sit with my wife. I was like, you know, they were taking all these precautions of keeping us, you know, 6 feet apart in a line and literally wrapped around the whole airport for one flight. And then they jammed us all in one room. Like, what was the point? Like, it was like we were literally shoulder to shoulder, like freaking sardines packed in this one room before we got on the plane. I was like, I went through all this ordeal and went through all this stress. I'm like, I'm going to get COVID now, you know, and this is before anybody knew, you know,
what it was
that COVID is pretty much is, you know, it's not a death sentence like they made it out to get go. Anyway, I'm not going to minimize it because there's many people that lost their lives and whatever, but it definitely is not what it was painted to be. So,
we here in my province here now, and like I said, we don't want to get onto the subject, but like we just had like 11 new cases, a million people. And one of the restrictions that came out, and I'm all for the church, stuff like that, but one of the restrictions that came out is you're only allowed 150 people at a church gathering.
Right.
Okay, so I'm okay with that. But now I'm going to give you two other scenarios that they cut back on. Same building.
Uh-huh.
Same congregation. Same guy at the front with the white collar. If it's a funeral, only 10 people. If it's a wedding, only 10 people.
Right.
Same building, same congregation.
Yeah.
Same guy at the front of the church.
Same bullshit here.
Like, it just don't make sense, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, I'm not going to keep you, brother. I know you got a lot of other things on the go today because we were talking about that before we got on the show. But I appreciate you coming on, man. Where can people find out, track you down?
Well, me personally, if you want to follow me, you know, Instagram, John Stallone, or Facebook, John Stallone, find out about the guide services or my podcast or anything or my blog, just go to daysinthewild.com. That pretty much will get you to anything that's associated with me.
Yep, perfect. Yeah. And hopefully your season coming up will be blessed with many tag draws in good areas.
Yeah.
Hopefully one of them's mine.
Yep.
I can't remember. I have no idea what area I put in. It was whatever you told me that night we were talking. I actually went back and looked. It was December 12th we were talking. And I wrote down the areas that you told me to put in for, and I did everything that you told me to do. So
nice. Well, yeah,
hopefully I'll be calling you back tonight, brother.
Yeah, it'd be nice, right?
Yeah.
One of these days I'm going to draw a freaking moose tag. We'll see.
But you don't have to draw moose tags up here. They're not over the counter, but you have to buy them through an outfitter. But we could definitely arrange something there for sure. Yeah. That.
No, I know, but I definitely need it. But where were we putting in together? Weren't we putting it in?
Oh, New Brunswick. New Brunswick.
Yeah.
Yeah. You do have to draw there. I just had my mind frame Newfoundland because that's where I've done most of my guiding. But
right. Yeah.
We'll get something to figure out. We'll hook up sooner or later. I'm trying to convince the wife. If you can figure out a way, now I've been married for 20 years, so I mean, I'm kind of committed there. is there any way I could get to Arizona and live? Because like after the other day, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, it's minus 20 here. He hunts elk. He hunts mule deer. He hunts coos deer. He's got javelina. He's got whitetail. And he's got sun. And only snow if he wants snow.
Right.
I said to her, I said, we got to figure something. We're doing something wrong here.
The problem with that is making a living as an outfitter in Arizona is very tough if that's all you're going to do.
Yeah. You know,
because of the tag situation. We don't have what like New Mexico has. And actually a lot of the other states have, you know, a program where if you apply with the outfitter, there's a higher chance of, you know, it's a separate pool. There's a higher chance that you're going to draw a tag. So they make it easier for outfitters to draw.
Get business.
Yeah. To draw clients, where over here, you don't have that. You know, you can get really big and you can do some of these hunts that you get, you know, like the over-the-counter deer and stuff like that. But then you're really only working for those 2 months, you know? So yeah, you can run a crap ton of clients and run a crap ton of.
Well, I mean, you got a big business going, like you got a big guiding business going, and you still got a construction business.
Yeah, so. I don't think my guide business. I consider it pretty still kind of small and boutique style. You know, I want my customers to have the best experience possible. And I feel like once you start growing to a certain point where you just have a bunch of guides working underneath you, it loses that.
Yeah, it loses that soul, so to speak.
The guides that work for me I'm not going to say they hunt like me. We all have our own style, but they all have the same goal in mind, and they're not just doing it for a paycheck. So it's like it works.
It's a passion for them, too.
It works. And
the clients feel that too. They could tell when somebody's there for the paycheck or somebody's there for the passion, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that definitely reflects on the business. And I think most clients like that. Most clients are, you know, if they're not a blue collar guy, they're very business oriented in their day to day life. So they want somebody that's just a sincere guy that's passionate, that, like, you know, and they feed off of us. Like, you know, when they're having a down day, they haven't seen many animals in a day or two, our positivity is still rocking through the roof because, you know, we know we got 3 days. We're not even halfway through the hunt. I'm not sweating it till, like, you know, after lunchtime on the last day.
Yeah. I feel the pressure.
I start feeling anxiety.
I feel like that's when I do my best work. Anyway,
I always work better under pressure.
Well, awesome, man. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I'm glad we got to sit down. I actually learned a lot about what you're doing that I didn't already know, so that's good. And hopefully my viewers took some from it, and they'll be in touch with you. Book a hunt.
Appreciate it.
All right, John. All right, thanks, man.
Good luck.
Take care. Be good.
Thanks. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out daysinthewild.com. And be sure to give us a review on iTunes. Thank you, and we'll check you out on the next episode.